Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisa Kores, the Chair of the Club Science and Technology Member-Led Forum and your Chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Professor George Church, and moderator Thomas Goetz. Dr. George Church is Professor of Genetics at Harvard Medical School and Director of the Center for Computational Genetics, with degrees from Duke University in Chemistry and Zoology. Professor Church co-authored research on 3D software and RNA structure with Sung-Hoo Kim. His PhD from Harvard in biochemistry and molecular biology with Wally Gilbert included the first direct genomic sequencing method in 1984, initiating the Human Genome Project, then as a research scientist at newly formed Biogen Inc., and a Monsanto Life Sciences Research Fellow at UCSF. Professor Church invented the broadly applied concepts of molecular multiplexing and tags, homologous recombination methods, and array DNA synthesizers. Technology transfer of automated sequencing and software to Genome Therapeutics Corporation resulted in the first commercial genome sequence, the human pathogen H. pylori, in 1994. Professor Church has served in advisory roles for 12 journals, 5 granting agencies, and 22 biotech companies. Current research focuses on integrating biosystems modeling with personal genomics and synthetic biology. He has authored and co-authored more than 270 publications and 50 patents. In 2011, Professor Church was awarded the Bauer Award and Prize for Achievement in Science from the Franklin Institute and elected to the National Academy of Sciences. In 2012, he was elected to the National Academy of Engineering. Thomas Goetz is the executive editor of Wired Magazine. He oversees all aspects of Wired Magazine, from story conception to cover packages. In addition to guiding editorial content, Thomas writes frequently for the magazine on health and technology. His writing has been selected for the Best American Science Writing and the Best Technology Writing anthologies. Since Thomas joined Wired in 2001, the magazine has been nominated for 12 National Magazine Awards, has won 6, including 3 for general excellence. Thomas holds a Master of Public Health degree from the University of California at Berkeley and a master's degree in American Literature from the University of Virginia. He graduated from Bates College. Please join me in welcoming Professor George Church and moderator Thomas Goetz.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming as well on a lunchtime event. I thought there would be a smattering of people, but it's wonderful to see the room all filled up. George, I had the opportunity to first meet you, I think it was 2006 or 2007, when it was one of the first meetings of the Personal Genome Project, the first group of 10 people who were taking what seemed like then radical step, to still to many of us is a radical step, of to kind of divulging not only their genomes, but all these other material things about them, their health, their other exposures, their backgrounds, as a way of creating a new kind of database. And it was an amazing moment. It was at your office in Harvard on the Boston side. I think I was one of two journalists there. I think there was a reporter from Science there, Erica. And it was remarkable to me because I really felt like I was on the cusp of something that was very much ahead of even my exposure at Wired, where we're always trying to ride the future. You were doing something and creating something with a personal genome project that was way out front to the point where the IRB at Harvard, the Institutional Review Board, had a hard time grasping the scale of the project. And I want to get to the kind of particularities of the PGP in a moment, but just as a way of getting started, I think that's really the way you've spent your career, is always so far ahead of your colleagues in science that it's always been a little bit tough for people to understand exactly at times what you're talking about. I wonder, with this new book that we're here for today, the Regenesis book, which is very much about this world that is we're on the threshold of but isn't here yet. I wonder, just to start, what that's like for you to always be kind of talking to people about what's going to happen, talking about the way science is going to unfold, but isn't quite visible yet.
Well, that's a good starting point, the question, in the sense that why would one talk about the future? And I think one of the reasons is that I've been reinforced to do this, is that the future is arriving faster than it should occasionally, rather than longer. I mean, we're still waiting for the Jetsons experience, so that's slower than expectations. But what's happening faster is the world of biology, and in particular reading and writing DNA. We had a projection, a very optimistic and even forward-looking exponential expectation, maybe, of it going as fast as computers go, which is very fast. It's 1.5-fold improvement every year, multiplicative, exponentially improving. So if you believe that applied to genetics and you extrapolate it out from our $3 billion genome that we got around 2000, 2004, then it should be about 50 years from now that we would get one that's in the low thousands, that is to say affordable rather than billions. And indeed it arrived, instead of 50 years later, it arrived 6 years later. So occasionally things happen faster than we expect, and that's with exponential expectation. And we need to prepare for them. So one of the reasons, there are all kinds of unintended consequences and just bad things can happen if you don't plan for these things. So that's one of the reasons that I talk about the future. And we're heavily involved in the technology development, and if you're doing technology development rather than just being an early adopter and technology consumer, you also have to talk about the future because you're writing grants and so forth.
Right. So one of the things that has, I think, informs your perspective that is essential to I think, more important to understanding kind of your perspective, is that you've always had this fusion of the computational world with the biological world, which now seems quite established and quite expected in many respects. But when you were starting your career, it was not at all the norm. You have these great stories about how you kind of got your computational bones, so to speak, in the computer that you found
basement of my math department in ninth grade.
In high school.
Yeah, which was essentially unused.
It was just a computer sitting there and the school didn't know what to do with it, but you figured it out.
Yeah. And the reason that would even happen is it wasn't really a computer, it was a teletype connected to Dartmouth. And so it was no investment in it had been donated to them and it was an inexpensive piece of equipment. But yeah, nobody was using it. Yeah.
So that kind of that intuitive grasp of computation and the digital world was really something you took to your graduate work and your work in science. You know, zoology, just the word doesn't sound at all like it has anything to do with the digital world, but right. But you were actually making those connections back in the early 80s.
Yeah.
And what, I mean, how was it, how was, especially given the perspective of today's technology, how, what was it like to work with such rudimentary tools in terms of the computation?
Well, you know, when you're at the cutting edge, you don't really, you feel like they're not rudimentary until a few years later when you look back at them and say, yeah, that was pathetic. Because at the time, you sort of feel like, well, it's better than everybody else, right? And the goal was not to be better than everybody else. I mean, there's some people who literally just have to have the, you know, cutting edge just to be better, be more. But this was because I couldn't see how to do what I wanted to do without the computing technology, at least some kind of computing technology. And I tend to be very frugal, so a lot of my life has been bringing the costs of things down, which isn't necessarily that sexy. When you bring it down a million fold, sometimes it starts to add up. So even with primitive computers, you can do a lot if you're dedicated to writing good software and thinking out of the box, basically.
Right. And that, I think that that experience in kind of making the tools, helping, being part of the creation of the tools, the digital tools, and bringing them into biology is really something that is the kind of prototype for synthetic biology, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Synthetic biology is very much, it's not just science in the way we think of science as you know, researching the way things are. It's really trying to change the, right. The fundamental conception of what biology is and what computation is. Mm-hmm. I mean, that takes a certain different grasp of what you can do with biological materials. When did you first start to think about this, I guess, what is now called synthetic biology, but I don't know when that term, right. When you first started using that term, but when did you first start reckoning with the potential to actually move into the world of synthesis?
Yeah, well, so to some extent, my original way that I found a connection between computers and biology was called crystallography, the crystallography of biological molecules, which was one of the few fields of science and biology in particular that used computers and a little bit of automation where we would collect data with something that looked kind of like a robot. This was when I was a teenager, actually, in the early 70s. And we would use very pure things, which in a way are synthetic, and we'd also make synthetic, very, very short pieces of synthetic DNA and RNA, like two nucleotides long, and that was amazing, right? Put that in perspective, genomes are 6 billion nucleotides per cell in your body. So we would make two nucleotides, and I thought that was pretty exciting. And then when I transitioned to graduate school, I got involved in sequencing the first synthetic vector. A vector is a ring of DNA into which you can put foreign genes. So you could put the human insulin gene into this bacterial vector. And we happened to, Greg Sutcliffe and I, we were graduate students together, we happened to be at the right place at the right time where someone needed to sequence the vector so that everybody could use the vector as a tool for cloning all the human proteins, genes at the time. And the vector we've chose turned out to be a semi-synthetic one, meaning we didn't synthesize every base pair, but the recombinant DNA gurus of the time put this thing together, we sequenced it, and it was used for years afterwards. In fact, parts of it are still in use today. So it was a good choice.
So that's when you started to realize that the potential for biology and using computational biology was not just to read DNA, but to start writing
right.
it as well,
mm-hmm.
Which is this, again, this fundamental change of perspective that I think, you know, was open doors that we're only just starting to exploit.
Yeah.
When you start to think about, I want to get to this kind of some of the synthesis work that you're looking at. You have this great phrase in your book that goes back to Pasteur, Louis Pasteur, all life from life. This notion that life has its origins only in other life forms, which for Pasteur was important in terms of combating the idea of spontaneous generation, right?
Right.
But for you, that phrase has new resonance, and I wanted to just kind of get you to explain that.
Right. Well, so Louis Pasteur was specifically dealing with the crisis of people thinking that life just spontaneously arose when it was really contamination with either microorganisms or even larger organisms that would sneak into your rich broth. He was not ruling out the possibility that life at some point came from inanimate material through evolution, or the possibility that we could create new life from inorganic materials in a laboratory. He was just referring to day-to-day, when mold gets on bread, it's not spontaneous, it actually came in from the air. So we are getting to close to the point where we can create living material, that is to say, capable of replicating, making copies of itself almost from atoms, certainly from very simple parts. I don't know exactly when that'll be, but we're much closer than we've ever been.
And that is the essence of synthetic biology.
That is one of the goals. I wouldn't even say it's in the mainstream, because there are many things. The beauty of synthetic biology is you don't need to be able to do these purest extreme exercises. Synthetic biology, in a way, is easier than the rest of biology because you don't have to understand all of biology. You take the part of biology that you trust and you use it as is. So you don't need to deconstruct it back to atoms. You don't need to understand all of the parts of the genome which are still mysterious. You just delete those, and if the thing survives, then you don't need to understand them.
And the objective, so I want to get into the mechanics. Yeah. I want to do this a little backwards. I want to talk about the objectives first.
Yes.
And then
forwards. That's
right, okay.
Everybody needs to know why we're doing this.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Right.
So you use E. coli and yeast predominantly, right?
Yeah.
Because they're very simple, and you understand, as you say, how they work. You understand the kind of...
Well, more important than being simple, there are simpler organisms. Is there already in use in industry?
Right.
Right. So yeast is used in bread and wine and manufacturing biochemicals, and so is E. coli is used in a variety of chemical processes.
Right, yeah. Rob Carlson, the biologist, has this great... perspective that one of the original biotechnologies was actually breweries.
Yes,
I mean that is
absolutely
biotechnology in a very real sense.
Yeah.
Now with those using those organisms, what we consider kind of laboratory organisms, but you see them as being able to be put to work for very kind of explicit purposes.
Right.
And I have a list of them here, but I don't know how you want to tackle them. They go from biofuels to creation of new medicines and onto cloning and stuff like that,
right.
Storage. Why don't we just start with the fuels? Because I think
that
is an easy one to grasp.
Right.
How does synthetic biology kind of what is the mechanism that creates it into turns
right.
it into fuels?
So fuels are one of the hardest tasks for synthetic biology to take on, even was one of the first, because it's so commoditized. It's so easy to just stick a tube into the ground and pump fuel out. And that's what we're competing with. But we now have some synthetic biology solutions that are quoting numbers around $1.28 a gallon. So it's competitive. Now, what happens with... So fuels are a hard category, but they're easy in a certain sense because the drop-in fuels that you put into motors are very closely related in structure to the fatty acids that are present throughout all of our bodies, surrounding each of our cells. Those fatty acids, all you have to do is remove the oxygens to make the fuels. And so this is a good goal for synthetic biology. So local companies like LS9 are making fuels and Juul back east. All of them are setting up production facilities in the sunnier areas, Texas, New Mexico, and Florida.
These are two of the companies that have
two of the companies
spun out
I helped start. Yeah.
And let me just poke at the biofuels thing, because you know we're in a boom of petrochemicals right now. I mean, the natural gas discovery is going crazy, and access to oil in Canada. We're actually on the threshold of this kind of fabled energy independence.
Right.
Why do we need biofuels? Why do we have to go back there?
Right.
Or keep plugging at that hard science problem when we've got these ready sources.
Right. So what the biology can do that you can't really get from natural gas or new oil and coal is those will all produce carbon dioxide, but the biological processes will either remove carbon dioxide from the air or at a minimum recycle it. In other words, take carbon dioxide out of the air, turn it into fuel, and then back into the air. That's a very potent, so they're using sunlight to produce energy in a liquid form that's compatible with current infrastructure. So you don't have to spend trillions of dollars changing all the engines and all the gas pumps and storage facilities. And the liquid fuel, even if you could change all that infrastructure, liquid fuel might be better in general than say gas or, gaseous, hydrogen or electric, because it is, it's incredibly compact and doesn't require pressure. So it's about 50 times more compact than the best battery.
In terms of energy density.
Yeah, and energy density. I think the main thing is the carbon dioxide, is we need a way of capturing the sunlight and the carbon dioxide. And if you turn it into something other than fuels, which we have, plastics or asphalt or something like that, then it's a net removal of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere.
Right. So let's just, this is an important point, so I want to make sure people understand it. The idea is that in order for the life form to be developing the fuel or the other product, the kind of fuel that they use is carbon dioxide, right?
Yes,
so they're
right.
Pulling carbon dioxide out of the air, out of the environment, and then turning it into something else.
Right.
Where with traditional oil, it's sitting there and are burning it, it's right. Creating a net gain of
exactly.
CO2.
Right.
Now you mentioned asphalt and
plastics.
And how does that work? How do those come out of?
Well, if those are turning carbon dioxide into something that we don't burn, then it's a net decrease in the carbon dioxide in the air. Now, these would have to be on a truly huge scale to have an impact, but every little bit helps. And to the extent that these are like forests and agricultural species, but much more effective. So it's been estimated that these are 100 times more efficient at producing fuels per photon, per light wave coming in, than is the corn to ethanol strategy.
Right.
So the corn to ethanol is not synthetic biology. It was just lobbying, basically, and it's not efficient.
One of the challenges with turning with the photosynthesis using photosynthesis is the density of the of the algae is the sunlight actually mm-hmm. when it's really working well, you can't get the sunlight through, right?
Right.
So you have to when you're talking about scale, when you're talking about really making a dent in the amount of energy we use, you're talking about massive
right.
surface area,
yes.
right? I mean,
right.
you have to just sprawl right. out. I think in the book you talk about it's the equivalent of the state of Massachusetts. Is that?
Yeah, or the panhandle of Texas, or depending on which state you think has lots of available land.
How do you?
But that would supply the entire United States, just the panhandle of Texas, and it's 100 times less land than if you tried to do grass or corn or sugarcane.
Interesting.
And the land that you use can be non-agricultural land because the entire thing is contained in thin film plastic. And the water you can use doesn't have to be the kind of high-quality, fertilized irrigation water. It can be kind of low-quality, brackish, or even seawater. So that means marginal lands and substandard water. Those are two of the biggest problems facing as we go forward you don't want to have a trade-off between energy and farming.
Right. So when some people have... When some companies have done this and created some volume, 20,000 gallons, I think, or 20,000 barrels,
yeah.
they did it, but at a cost of like $400
right.
A
yeah.
gallon, which
yeah.
just doesn't
right.
float in the
yeah.
real world market.
Yeah.
You mentioned you just had a phrase
$1.28. Yeah.
Now who is that?
So that is Joule. This number was announced. In a number of press coverages, a deal with Audi. So the car manufacturer made a a large partnership with exclusively with Juul, which is kind of a vote of confidence in mm-hmm. their technology. And that number, I got that number from those news articles.
$1.28 per gallon.
Per gallon.
Wow. Yeah. So medicine is another thing that you see coming arising out of that. How does that work?
So medicine is in a way a better application. I mean, fuels is fine; it's working. It's hard. You're competing with a very simple commodity. Medicine, the pharmaceutical compounds are very complicated, and the more effective ones are even more complicated. In other words, they come from nature, and they have all kinds of bond angles and structure, which is hard to achieve with ordinary organic chemistry, much less petrochemical-derived chemistry. And so this is a huge opportunity. And all it requires is you find all the enzymes. So, for example, artemisinin was made by wormwood, and Taxol was made from the yew tree. And they're made in trace amounts because those plants only need to make a little bit to, say, discourage an insect or whatever they're using it for. But if you take the enzymes out and then now make them as the major thing that the E. coli is making or the yeast is making, now suddenly you can, instead of going from some trace amount in some exotic wood, you can now make a factory that's really only making this product and very little else.
And that's work that Jay Kiesling is doing at Berkeley right now.
Jay worked on the artemisinin, and there are other groups that are working on Taxol.
And so it works.
It worked well enough that the Gates Foundation funded it for a long time, and now it's been acquired by a major pharmaceutical company.
Right. And then we get to the clones, the part where your book, I think, deliberately gets a little provocative and scary, but the idea of finding ways to bring back species. What is the argument for doing that?
So, again, very important to ask the why up front. Why should we be provocative and scary and talk about the future? It's so that if it arrives early, we're prepared for it. We've had broad discussions of different kinds of stakeholders and non-stakeholders that are thinking creatively about all the risks and benefits. Why bring back? First of all, we are bringing back extinct species as a society. We've already brought back the 1918 flu virus. I think it would. I didn't do this, but the point is, it's arriving faster than some people are aware, and we should have talked about that a little bit more before we did it. Okay, but there are justifications for that, which is to prepare us for similar epidemics in the future. We need to know in depth how that thing worked. That will presumably only be used under high containment. But let's talk about bigger, more charismatic species like mammoths. An argument can and has been made by some of my colleagues in Siberia, which is representative of one of the largest ecosystems in the world, which is all the tundra across Scandinavia and Canada and Russia. Huge environment that used to be mostly luxurious grasslands because the mammoths would come through. They're the only species that could survive in that cold climate, and they would knock down all the trees, and they would eat the grass, which otherwise would cover itself up with its own dead grass and block its own photosynthesis. They would eat that, and it was one of the most productive parts of the world, even though it was very cold. And there's many meters of permafrost, which are being lost now, and that's full of microorganisms from many millennia of mammoth poop and so forth, and it's going to be releasing methane and carbon dioxide if the permafrost doesn't stay permafrost. And there are other advantages of it staying that way, which is that it has grasslands have a high albedo, meaning reflecting light compared to forests. So anyway, the point is with the humans killing off the mammoths fairly recently, we're converting it from luxurious grasslands to things that are absorbing light and produce and likely releasing a big bolus of carbon dioxide and methane, which are huge global warming. So all of those factors together.
So this is basically terraforming, but the agent is
something that was already been around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
you So you get the mammoths, you put them back in the ecosystem, exactly. And then you let them
right.
do their work.
Yeah, and a small test has been done in a thing called Pleistocene Park, which is in Siberia,
right.
where they've introduced slightly smaller, much smaller herbivores, the biggest herbivores that we have, to see if they can recreate the grasslands and save the permafrost. And it looks like it might be working, but it would, of course, work even better with some elephant-like creature, Indian and African elephants don't like it up in Siberia.
Right. So what is the time horizon for that kind of thing?
Well, so there are many ways of de-extincting. So in the case of
de-extincting,
that's right?
The phrase.
Resurrecting, or whatever you want to call it. Yeah. Bringing back extinct species. One of them is if you have a frozen cell, so cells that get frozen in the laboratory do very well. One extinct species has been brought back, the ibex, briefly. If you don't freeze it well, then you have to take the nucleus out because the cell is destroyed. But the nucleus, amazingly, mice have been frozen in a regular, refrigerator freezer for 20 years, 16 to 20 years, and you can take the nucleus out and make a living mouse. So there's some hope, although I would not consider it a very high probability, that there may be some mammoth nuclei out there. Short of that, we have now sequenced mammoth DNA, and what we do is take an elephant cell from an existing elephant, and then with new technology, which is still in development, introduce the sequences that are different between the mammoth and the elephant, starting with the ones that would make it most capable of living in a cold climate, because all we really need is an herbivore that can survive in that climate year-round.
And are you doing this work in your lab?
We are developing basic technology that will allow us to do this. We're testing it out on Neanderthal human cells, just cells, but exactly the same protocols would work for mammoths, and we would be delighted to do that if there's general agreement that it's a good idea.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the process. Let's talk about exactly what is going on the genetic level.
Yeah.
Explain the basic kind of mechanism of synthetic genomics.
Right. You can either design an organism from scratch. It doesn't. When you say from scratch, you're usually being inspired by one or more genomes that already exist. So you can make a chimeric genome that would be hard to obtain in ordinary laboratory experiments. You can use what we know about biology, the parts that we trust, and piece them together in a computer. So now you've got a string of A, C's, G's, and T's that constitute a hypothetical genome in the computer. You can now break that up into pieces that are short enough that you can synthesize them chemically. So this is organic chemistry, not biochemistry, and make these short pieces. Unfortunately, you can't make the whole thing in one stretch. Make these short pieces, and then you piece them together now using biochemistry rather than organic chemistry. And then finally, genetics, you introduce it into some sort of living cell, and it will either replace a piece of the living cell, or it will in some other way start making copies of itself, replicating in the living cell.
So, and this can work, conceivably, this can work if you want to turn an E. coli to doing something slightly different in terms of producing fuel, or if you want to turn an elephant a piece of elephant DNA into actually a mammoth. That's
right.
It's just that's the basic process.
Right.
It's you're hijacking in a sense the living cell with this other directions. Okay, and that works.
It does. Yes. Not mammoths, but yet. But you can change almost any piece of any genome. So I can change a human genome to have a new sequence in any part of the human genome we want, multiple different parts of the genome. And this is actually of medical significance. And the same thing we can do it for. So to show what we can do with human, which we could also do with mammoths, you can take out your stem cells. Let's say you have AIDS, you can take out your stem cells. With a molecular machine called the zinc finger nucleus, you can specifically target the receptor for the HIV virus and destroy both copies of that gene that you got, one from your mother and one from your father, destroy both copies, then take those engineered cells and put them back in your body, and now you become AIDS resistant. You, even if you have full-blown AIDS, these cells are now resistant to the virus, and this is now in phase two clinical trials at a company called Sangamo.
Is that in the United States?
It's in California, yeah.
Right. And so Craig Venter did this, he created kind of the first, what was called the first synthetic organism in 2010, I think, right? So we're just at the dawn of this, but you see virtue in what he did was kind of using using an extant organism and then modifying it with a synthetic string. Now you see virtue in basically booting up a synthetic string of DNA on itself, right? Is that?
Well, I think what Craig did is he made a copy of something that already existed in a closely related cell without an obvious practical application. And before him, people had made synthetic viruses, both for poliovirus and hepatitis C and a variety of other, in 1918 flu virus and so forth, making a bacterial species. Most of the synthetic biology success stories are not making a carbon copy of something, an exact copy synthetically, but making a few changes. Because in practice, even the one where you make the entire thing synthetically, if it looks like a previous genome, you really haven't changed it much. So what's critical is how much you change it and whether those changes are going to lead to an important new property, right? So the 1918 flu virus is not that different from a bunch of other influenza viruses. It's just a few nucleotides make all the difference. So you don't really have to synthesize the whole thing. You can just make some small changes. Same thing for E. coli that produces fuels or yeast that makes artemisinin. You don't have to synthesize the whole genome in order to have very radical changes in the properties of the cell.
Right. So this, and you're doing this oftentimes you talk about it as instant evolution.
Accelerated evolution. Yeah.
It's evolution not on a scale of thousands of years, but right. Really fast
right.
adaptation.
Yeah.
The question I have is something we say at Wired a lot. What could possibly go wrong?
Right. Well, because I
you asked that yourself.
I asked that myself, possibly more than my colleagues do. And part of the reason that we talk about the future is so that we can think about this the way that many other engineering disciplines do. That's one of the things that distinguishes synthetic biology is intentionally an engineering discipline. And engineering means that you have standards, that you have parts you trust that are very well characterized rather than just bashing things together without standards, and that you have safety engineering. So a civil engineer that builds a building or a bridge makes sure that it's going to be resistant to earthquakes and typhoons. Someone who builds a car puts in seat belts and airbags. This is safety engineering. It's well established. If we put that up front for biology and think about it from as many ways it can go wrong as we can, we may forget something, but we will forget less if we have a whole discipline dedicated to it.
So how does that work? Give me an example of what you're hedging against and then how you...
So for example, there's a concern that if you made a superorganism, something that is extra strong. Now, so far, most things you make that work in the lab or work in the factory haven't got a chance in the wild. But there are certain things that could have a chance in the wild, and they could take over if you gave it the right properties. So one way of protecting against that is building into the superorganism metabolic dependence on something they can only get from the lab. A chemical compound which is not found in the wild anywhere, and you make it totally dependent, and you test that by growing it in physical isolation inside the lab with diverse ecosystems, microcosms, and see whether it can obtain it, so that maybe you've made it dependent, but if it swaps out part of its genome, it can now get rid of that dependence. So what you do two things then. You make it dependent, and you make it so it can't swap its genome out. You make its genome incompatible with the rest of the world. So it can't contaminate the environment with its DNA, and the DNA from the environment can't come in and fix its addiction.
Is that where mirror life comes in?
Well, so there's two ways that we're doing it. The closest one is changing the genetic code of existing organisms, and the other one is flipping the handedness of the organism.
I think you should explain what flipping the handedness
right.
of the organism.
Right. So, if
E. coli doesn't have right and left hands.
Exactly. So let's. It might even be easier to talk about someone who does have left and right hands. So if I made a mirror image of you, you would look the same. You'd basically look the same. You would, however, if you weren't aware of the situation, you would reach out what looks like your left hand, but you would think it's your right hand. Okay. Because all the molecules in your body are flipped. So just like your right and your left hand can't be rotated to fit on top of one another. Your left glove, if it's a rigid glove, will not fit on your right hand. It can only be represented by a mirror. Well, at the molecular level, this is really true. Every organism is full of molecules that are called handed, meaning that they have a structure which cannot be rotated to produce the other hand, the left to the right. And it's a world of itself. If we made the opposite-handed version of you, you would not be able to eat the things that you currently eat because all those foods have a handedness.
Right, those molecules, the nutrition molecules are...
Exactly.
Okay.
But we could make those nutrition molecules for your other hand and person.
Right.
And then they'd be able to eat. There are a small number of biological substances which have no handedness. Glycine, glycerol and acetate are three of the top ones. And those things you could share with other organisms. But everything else, you would be impervious to all insults. You would no longer get any diseases. No viruses could touch you, no bacteria, no fungus. And if we mirror flipped your clothes, they would not rot. Moths could not eat them. So it's a very interesting world.
But I couldn't eat.
Well, we'd have to make food for you.
Right.
Yeah.
Or you could
make your own food. But
okay.
with some pretty sophisticated chemistry.
But that has virtues in terms of this flipping the chirality has virtues in terms of medicines as well, right? Because
yes.
It has antiviral.
Absolutely.
Can you just
So just like your clothes won't rot, wood would not rot or get worms in it. Molecules that we put into our bodies either cause an immune reaction. Or they get destroyed by enzymes and they get cleared from your system quite quickly. And this is one of the problems with certain pharmaceuticals. And so we can now make a whole new class of pharmaceuticals that cause less immune problems and last longer in your body. It opens up a whole new world of chemistry. It's not just twice as much chemistry. It's if you have a long polymer, meaning a series of molecules that can be either left or right-handed, then at every stage you can choose either the left or right hand, so it's not just two times as many, it's two to the n power. So it's a really big world of chemistry that opens up.
And so for something like antibiotic resistance, this is important because you could actually create medicines that the bacteria couldn't mutate to resist against. Is that?
I wouldn't go that far.
Oh,
no.
Come on.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I thought I had you.
But you could make cells that the bacteria couldn't infect. Because the enzymes don't work.
Right.
So you don't need to kill the bacteria because they can't touch
it
anyway.
Okay.
Yeah.
Bonus. Well, I want to get some questions going. One thing that I just wanted to, as we get the microphone up, is there going to be a microphone?
Oh, yeah. I was going to do some programmer identification. So thanks to Professor George Church and moderator Thomas Goetz for their comments here today. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Regenesis, How Synthetic Biology Will Reinvent Nature and Ourselves, with Professor George Church and moderator Thomas Goetz. Now, we open the floor to a Q&A. We have about 15 to 20 minutes. We have a standing microphone. So if you could come up to the front and ask your questions, make sure to speak into the microphone as we are recording.
This might. Oh, there it is.
Thank you, Rabbi.
You skirted around human beings, and in terms of the future, specifically, what effect could this have for designer babies, just for a starter? There are clones and other things as well, but designer babies, which is a topic we don't talk enough about, I think.
Right. Well, what we consider socially acceptable changes with how well the technology works. If the technology works very well and is inexpensive enough that it's broadly available, then it switches from something that's undesirable to something where it's immoral to prevent parents from having healthy babies or whatever their goal for their children is. So if, you know, a lot of parents will go to great extremes to get 50 points for their child on their SAT, 50 extra points. And there's no doubt that they would, if you had a safe and inexpensive, broadly available method, it would be very hard to deny parents that right. It will begin and has already begun with treatments like this anti-HIV, which is doing genetic manipulation of adult cells into adults, and then it will drop down to child cells into child and fetal cells into fetus. And you could say that someone who has deleted both of their genes for the virus receptor is an augmented human being. They have something that most humans don't have, which is a resistance to HIV. And just because it is augmentation or designer genes doesn't mean that it's bad or that people would deny AIDS patients this possibility.
I'm a member of the BioCurious community lab in Sunnyvale, which I think you know a little bit about.
I do.
And as a non-scientist, I find this whole field really, really exciting. And there are numerous folks in the lab that are like myself, that are not PhDs and non-scientists, that are working hard to understand molecular biology in this new field. I wonder if you could chat a little bit about kind of this whole broadening community of non-scientists that are interested in this, and what the pros and cons are and the challenges, and how we can sort of expedite the development of this field.
Right. So many analogies are being made between do-it-yourself biology and BioCurious and GenSpace in New York and so forth as analogy to homebrew electronics, which included some people that were very skilled in the art and some people that were newbies, but became world experts as needed. I think there's a similar opportunity now. The playing field is quite level since the costs have plummeted faster than even electronics can imagine at, tenfold per year. This suddenly creates all kinds of opportunities for new people to come in and become world experts. So I think we need to do it very responsibly, especially when we're talking about human health, and synthetic biology is very powerful in the hands of the individual, and as is reading your own genome. You need to you don't necessarily have to have everything done by a card-carrying member of the American Medical Association, but in the same sense that we didn't need to have a professor of computer science to lead us all by the hand into the World Wide Web. But we do need to have some kind of standards and responsibility.
Thank you. On precisely that note, I am one of the civil engineers who's familiar with the safety engineering you brought up before, and I wanted to know, given the rapid decrease in cost, do you think that we will have an institution to create those sort of standards or common understanding before the benchtop revolution in this field makes it or forces the issue? Do you feel that we will be out in front of it, or do you feel that events will overtake the ability to set in those safeguards?
I think so,
who's working on it?
Yes. So I think we have been out in front of it. It's very challenging. It's part of the reason that I produced this book, is to keep us out in front of it. There's never been a field of technology that's gone this fast, so it's a little, I would be rash to say we can stay out in front of it. We are doing things like in 2004, I put out a white paper proposal that was broadly sent among various government and other agencies about doing licensing and surveillance. I think licensing and surveillance is a piece of cake for cars. you know, teenagers get licenses, and there's radars to measure your speed. We need to, the stakes are even higher for synthetic biology. We need to have licensing and surveillance. That's one way we can stay out ahead. There are many of the safety features we talked about earlier that my group and others are developing that are built into the chassis, we call them, the cells that people use. So there are standard settings going on there. Many of the companies involved in producing DNA have adopted some of these ideas from that white paper, and it's now close to an international standard that you check your oligonucleotide sequences but against a list of potential pathogens to make sure these people know what they're doing and are approved for it. That's in stark contrast to what it was when I first suggested it, where their lawyers were saying, don't ask, don't tell, that is to say, if you don't look at your orders, you're not responsible for them. That was irresponsible.
Can I just ask a follow-up? So on the regulatory world, are those – I know you as scientists are working hard on getting this consciousness raised, but are the regulators on top of it?
That was not just scientists. That was corporate leaders worldwide.
Right.
In addition, there are regulations in place regulating anything over 200 base pairs and double-stranded. I kind of objected to both of those, but at least that's progress in that they are regulating the double-stranded DNA sort of down to 200 base pairs. I think they should be regulating double and single-stranded down to about 40 base pairs or nucleotides.
So in a former life, I was a postdoc in Rudy's lab.
Yes.
And so now what I do is I work a little bit with NASA on increasing International Space Station utilization.
Yes.
We've seen some interesting, interesting things with both protein crystallization and also genetic regulation of pathogens in microgravity. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about opportunities you might see and how to sort of most efficiently use that resource.
Yeah, so, you know, I think that in a way it's an example of a tool looking for a use, and that doesn't mean that we will find terrific uses. I think the most important thing to be doing in terms of space biology is not necessarily studying things here on Earth that we can do, like we can make crystals on Earth. It's studying space biology itself. That is to say, we need to get off the planet. There are radiation risks. There are microgravity risks due to bone osteoporosis. Those are the things that I would urge us to study. We need to be able to get human beings off the planet.
So a general question about PACE and MAGE, two of the technologies developed in your lab. So can you talk about, obviously, the utility before we get to, you know, being able to synthesize the whole constructs much more cheaply, the application of those things. Can you talk about where they are right now and, you know, how they port to other chassis?
Right. Okay. So that was a very jargon-laden question that I will unpack for everybody else. PACE and MAGE are acronyms for what Thomas was referring to, accelerated evolution. I won't even de-acronymize them. Just say accelerated evolution. As an alternative for synthesizing every single base pair. Now, whatever fraction of the genome we decide to do accelerated evolution on, we can synthesize that more cheaply with chips, which is another difference from between our group and many others. Is since 2004, we've been making DNA from chips. It's about 1,000 to 10,000 times less expensive per nucleotide. The accelerated evolution allows us to generate not one genome at, you know, $1 million or more, but to generate billions of genomes, admittedly combinatorially generated, meaning swapping in pieces, for tens of thousands of dollars. So it's really becoming very inexpensive. And I see that that's, I'm not sure I fully answered your question, but that's how we're evaluating each new generation of PACE and MAGE and accelerated evolution in general, is how well can we make billions of genomes? Because unlike making cell phones, we have, or any other, you know, bridges, any other field of engineering, we have a unique opportunity with biological engineering in that we don't have to make one prototype at a time and hope and it works. We can make billions of different prototypes and see which one is the best.
Hello. Thank you to you both and to the Commonwealth Club. This has been a wonderful experience. I have a general question that I have kind of three small parts I'm interested in particular. But I see you as a leader, and I hear you as a leader in terms of thinking about the moral and social implications of the work that you're doing. And as you push our ability to know things or push our ability to do things, you are aware that every step forward has these social implications. You'd like to get out in front of it. So I'd appreciate any comments about that kind of leadership in general, but I was particularly interested in what responsibility you feel your people working, not at the leadership level, but as technicians or researchers have for their for the social implications of the work. I'm also interested in what kind of leadership you feel is most appropriate in other disciplines. And I'm also interested, this is, thank you to the Commonwealth Club, this is also part of a context of a broader science festival. So I was wondering about your interest in public forums for discussing implications of research.
Right. So a lot of stuff there. I'm definitely interested in public fora of having everybody at every level from, you know, dean to, you know, principal investigator to technician to the public involved in these decision making. I think there's huge responsibility. If you see something wrong, even if your job depends on it, you should report it. Being a whistleblower is a very good thing. If you anticipate something that may seem even a little science fiction-y, you know, blog about it, tweet about it, whatever, you know, get it out there. Somebody will pick up on it. The beauty of the internet is things will spread if they have any attractiveness at all, any basis in fact, or even about the future. So that's a responsibility for sure. One responsibility I'm not quite as keen on is the idea of trying to stop things. Not because I don't want to stop them. Sometimes I do want to stop them. Almost every technology at some point or another had somebody trying to stop it. Railroads, cars, you name it. And the amount of time that technologies are illegal or unwanted is shortening with time. But basically it's a false security to say that, oh, don't worry about it. We've got a moratorium on recombinant DNA. Well, that moratorium, I was in the thick of it. It was in the mid-1970s. It lasted only a few months, and during that time, we actually accelerated everything. We didn't literally do anything that was illegal at the time, but we did everything we could around the edges. So it didn't slow things down. If anything, it accelerated. And sometimes when you say something's dangerous, suddenly investors want to invest in it because they think it's edgy and cool, right? So you have to be very careful not only about what the things that you don't stop, but the things you do stop. Also, the things you stop can cost lives. So there are many reasons to be very cautious about moratoria. But the responsibility there is certainly bringing up the topics. And rather than stopping them, ask what would happen if they arrived early. That's the really key thing. Can we put safety engineering in place in case they arrive early rather than late? Assuming they're going to arrive late because you said something is very naive.
Yes, you spoke about bringing back extinct species, and I'm thinking about those that we're destroying right now.
Yes.
All those endangered, and I'll just give the example of fisheries, because like plankton, you know, scientists are worried that's the bottom of the food chain. I mean, that is a serious thing. So my question is, are there people thinking about trying to increase the populations?
Yes.
That exists now, and also adapting them to what we know is already happening, climate change.
Right. Excellent question, and I think it's part and parcel to this. To now, this thing was a bit of a fantasy when Thomas first heard about it, and maybe many of you, is now a Revive and Restore international project, and it is heavily populated by conservationists and environmentalists and ethicists who feel like one of the reasons that species are going extinct, it used to be many of the ones that went extinct already were because humans killed them and ate them. Probably the mammoths and definitely the passenger pigeons, we killed those in about 20 years because of the telegraph, railroads, and guns. Anyway, it's changed from that to us changing their environment because we have to, because there are 7 billion of us, and we don't have a lot of flexibility. We could have not killed the passenger pigeons. That was we didn't absolutely need that food in that particular form, But now we have climate change that's really hard to control. What that means is to save new existing species, we need to have diversity. Many species are very, very narrow. They get away with it for millennia, for millions of years, having a narrow genetic base because their environment's steady. You know, the cheetahs, sometimes are said they're not very diverse. Well, they're almost the same diversity of many other predators of their type. They're not particularly bottlenecked, but they're not ready for the modern world. So how do you get that diversity? You can get it from museum specimens of related species. There's huge diversity there that came from extinct. Just because they went extinct doesn't mean they're failures. They were amazing successes in their day, right? And so maybe bringing some of those genes into the gene pool could be a really positive thing for existing species. Certainly the point of the de-extinction or the revive and restore project is to increase our dedication to the existing species. Yeah.
All right, last question.
Could you explain the process by which genetic changes like HIV resistance are diffused through the human body?
Ah, yes. So that was a particularly good initial gene therapy. Well, it's not the first gene therapy, but it's the first of the modern type of gene therapies. Instead of putting like random viral delivery all over your body and all over your genome, which is a bad idea, this is highly directed to a particular cell type in a particular place in the genome, so it's much more targeted and precise. That's what's new 10 years after the first gene therapies were attempted. Because of that, and it's done outside the body, so you can have more control over which cells are targeted. In principle, you can do this it is done on stem cells of a variety of types. You can make some cases those stem cells into, in the case of HIV, there are circulating blood stem cells, but you could also, in principle, make it to solid tissues that you transplant the same way that you would do a normal transplant. And there's a lot of progress being made in making very complex tissues, either outside the body or in sophisticated in vivo manipulations.
Well, George, Drew Endy described your work as the high-throughput screen of ideas, which I think we've gotten a taste of the massive amount of stuff that is going on in your brain, and I really appreciate you coming to San Francisco and sharing it with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Can we take one more question? Is that okay if we take one last question? Is that okay?
And you brought up a subject that I was just going to ask Dr. Church, and that is, what does your work portend, if any, on the evolution of the human brain?
So the question is about the future of the human brain. We certainly have, that's a complex topic because a lot of society is dedicated towards making us all very similar to one another. I think the future of evolution in general is of diversity. It's of enabling diversity. So we've kind of passed through what I hope is a bottleneck where we've tried to apply the lessons learned in the Ford Motor Corporation of assembly line to education and to treating individuals with drugs. Obviously, there's some people that are in severe pain. They need to be made more normal in that sense. But there are many other people who are neuroatypical who need, rather than to be treated, need to have better environments where they can succeed. And I'm talking about people with ADD, high-functioning autistics, hyperthymistics, which have good memories but have other social skill problems. And the list goes on. We need to embrace these individuals with new educational paradigms. Furthermore, you know, we will get better at measuring brain activity. This is a big project that myself and others are involved in. Maybe the next genome project is measuring and changing the activity of individual neurons throughout the brain. That will help us understand what we need to do next. But I think this is, again, something we need to think about well in advance because it's a very big set of decisions ahead of us. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to Professor George Church and moderator Thomas Goetz for their comments here today. We also thank audience here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 190th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.